it might be brought to an end. He went forth from the comfortable environment and home that he lived in. He was rather high ranking and of a wealthy family, and lived the homeless life. And he went into the outback, pretty much, and lived the life of a wandering beggar for about the next 6 years, sitting with various different teachers and learning what he could about the ways of the mind. And then after he achieved enlightenment, he began to teach. His first disciples were basically people he'd been sitting with before, and he just simply shared with him what he had learned, and they started hanging out together. He started wandering around teaching, and more people wanted to join them. More and more people wanted to do what he did, which was to go forth from whatever life they had been living up until that period of time, and just travel with the Buddha, and ask for alms in order to support themselves, and offer teachings to the communities that were supporting them. So, over time, as his monastic sangha grew and grew and grew, we had this tradition of people who wanted to hang out with the Buddha, who wanted to travel with him, who wanted to be part of the group to do what's called taking refuge. Taking refuge in the Buddha, basically meaning taking on the protection of his being, of his teachings about how to overcome suffering, taking refuge in the fact that he had actually achieved that, and that he was not a god, that he was not a deity, that anyone basically had the capability of doing what he did. Taking refuge in the Dharma, which means taking refuge in the teachings themselves. There is this phrase in Buddhism, the Dharma protects those who protect the Dharma. So if you can really immerse yourself in the teachings about the practice of freedom, then you attain protection that goes along with that, protection from doing that which is harmful to yourself and others. Okay. And then taking refuge in the Sangha. Taking refuge in the Sangha means taking refuge in the spiritual community of which you're a part. So, taking refuge in the Sangha at the time of the Buddha meant joining his order, his monastic order. And in so doing, there's a great long list of vows that people who were joining that order would take. And basically, they were vows on how to live together in community. So they co-created a place of safety, of refuge, by virtue of these vows that they took. For people who wanted to follow the ways of the Buddha, but who didn't, their situation was not such that they could go forth, there is just this list of five precepts that he asked everyone to follow. The precept, and this is the same ones we take when we go on retreat, the ones of refraining from taking life, of refraining from taking that which is not given, not hitting on each other, not lying, and keeping the mind clear of, substances that prohibit the possibility of mindfulness from arising. So the principal metaphor the Buddha used about his teachings was following a path, going forth, and in so doing, you're kind of on the road. You're not protected as you were when you were at home safe in your beddy by, okay? Because you have undertaken this journey of spiritual discovery. And then along the way, you find refuge in the reality of being able to become free of realizing your own Buddha nature, the reality of the teachings being a means by which we can train the mind to see how we create suffering and how we keep it from, and how we can keep from doing so as well. And then how to live in a way in community with others, right? So that we can begin to manifest those teachings. So classically, back from the time of the Buddha going forward, when the word Sangha was used, it was intended to represent the monastic sangha, those who had come to follow the Buddha. And then even within the monastic sangha, some used the term in an even more conservative way to indicate those who had essentially attained the first stage of enlightenment, that they actually constituted a kind of a realm of higher consciousness. When I was undergoing my training to teach the Dharma, close to 20 years ago now, one of our teachers in the training program was a fellow named Ajahn Amaro. He's an English monk. He's a Theravada monk. He's been in robes for close to 40 years now. He was a student in Asia of Ajahn Chah, who was a Thai forest meditation tradition master. And as were some of my own teachers, like Jack Kornfield, for instance, and Guy Armstrong. And so when we were learning the meaning of some of these core terms in Buddha Dharma, the question that came up during our teaching was that as we use that term in the West, we also use it to refer to lay sanghas, to groups like ours, you know, who come together to practice and study the Dharma and seek to live it out in our daily lives. And the question arose, as it has, you know, within both Asian circles as well as here in the West, is that an appropriate use of the term? Because in Asia, it's used to refer primarily just to the monastic sangha, and then the lay followers, there's a sort of a different name for them, actually. But here, we take a different approach. So someone asked Ajahn Amaro, is it appropriate to use that term, for instance, for sitting groups and Buddhist organizations here in the United States? And he said, well, basically, the word sangha, literally, in Pali, means assemblage. He said, you can have a sangha of birds, you know. And so someone said, well, you just mean like a heap of the same stuff? And he said, well, no, not really. If you look at a flock of birds, what it is a coming together, an association of conscious beings for a common purpose. So if you look at birds that flock together, you can see that sometimes it looks almost like one entity, right? Because they're all in such close communication with the others. So they are definitely achieving, and the same holds true with geese, and, you know, they are seeking to achieve, to assemble, to achieve a common purpose. And so that's what a sangha is. In Asia, people who wanted to learn about the Dharma would go to the wats and the monasteries and whatnot, hear the Dharma from the monastics, and that was how it was done. What you do not find, even today, in an awful lot of Southeast Asia, is what we have had happen here in the West, especially over the course of the last 20 years or so. So some of our Western teachers, like Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, and others, they came back from after a lot of sitting and practice and hearing teachings in Asia, and they started teaching almost 40 years ago now. And so those who wanted to practice Buddha Dharma, at least in the Theravada tradition, basically you'd go away on retreat. And then you'd come home and you'd practice at home, and then you'd go away on retreat again, and then you'd come back again. And it was powerful, and a lot of us were kind of drawn to the practice, and it gradually became a way of life. But it was also a little bit schizophrenic, because we'd go away on these, you know, these 10-day or 2-week intensive silent meditation retreats, get way deep samadhi going. And then we come out like, whoa, where am I? What was that? You know, and go back home again and try to re-enter daily life. And it was actually a little bit traumatic sometimes. And so then arose the notion of, well, maybe we could have some local sitting groups to help you sort of keep your practice steady, you know, so you don't necessarily like lose ground before you go away on your next retreat. But it was all about just providing enough local support to keep your practice alive and well until you went on the next retreat. That model really began to shift and to morph into something fundamentally different about 20 years ago, or 18, 20 years ago. And it had a fair amount to do, actually, with the teacher training program that I underwent. Because the idea behind the Community Dharma Leaders training program was that instead of just, you know, going on retreats to get your fix, you deepen your practice, and then you go home and try to get maintenance doses, you know, until you went on retreat again. The whole idea was to begin to develop communities wherever you lived, so that rather than just being a place to come sit together, the communities, the local sanghas, actually began to perform the same function and perform the same function that the sanghas, monastic sanghas, traditionally have for the last 2,500 years, which is to actually become vehicles for the sustaining and the learning about and the transmission of the Dharma. And so that is the place to which we have found ourselves coming. You know, a lot of us still go on retreats, especially those of us who teach in the Sangha. And retreat practice is absolutely vital to keeping our own understanding and our own teaching authentic. But there has been a real historic shift in the West over the course of the last 20 years or so, as we've had more and more robust practice communities popping up all over the country, you know, in ways that simply did not exist, you know, 20 or so years ago. So we find ourselves in kind of a new realm historically, insofar as the conservation of, the sharing of, the transmission of the Dharma in the West is concerned. And so what Ajahn Amaro said, you know, in this discussion, he said, well, you know what? The sanghas that are now developing at the community level in the West are essentially performing the same kinds of functions as have the monastic sanghas in Asia over the millennium. So that he said in his view, it was entirely appropriate for that word to be used for local sanghas like ours, which are in fact functioning to both maintain and also to share the Dharma in the West. So that's why, you know, in my own languaging, I tend to differentiate between monastic sanghas and lay sanghas, or monastic sanghas and sitting group sanghas. Sangha, in this use of the term, and as Ajahn Amaro described it, is a little bit more than just people who get together and sit from time to time, because there's more going on, you know, and we're really striving here to make sure that we do have an ongoing program of, you know, what to the best of our ability and knowledge are authentic teachings of the historical Buddha from the Theravada tradition, of various kinds of community activities and subgroups and whatnot that help perpetuate that as well. And we can talk more about those a little bit later on in our time together. But in fact, we are in the West, you know, we are the Dharma. A little scary, isn't it? The Dharma is not separate from us, you know. We embody it. You know, somebody asked, also some of our teachers, including Ajahn Amaro, okay, how do you determine who's a Buddhist or not? And his response was, you're a Buddhist if you say you are. And for those who don't feel comfortable expressing any particular religious or spiritual affiliation, it's perfectly okay also to not call yourself a Buddhist, right? Because it has that connotation of signing up like for, you know, one baseball team or another or something, and when in fact, it's up to you whether or not you want to self-identify in that regard. If you think the Buddha was right in terms of the reality of suffering, the origins of suffering, the ending of suffering, and the means by which that might be achieved, and that's how you seek to live your life, at least on the outside, it kind of looks like you're a Buddhist, you know, whether or not you call yourself one or not. Okay. So what does it mean to take refuge in the Sangha? What it's not is running away from the world. What it's not is trying to avoid suffering, whether it's your own suffering or the suffering that we see about us. What it is about is creating a community of self-care for those of us who are on the path. So if you think of it as like us all being on a big lifelong backpacking trip, which is to some degree kind of what was going on in the Buddha's time, you know. His followers would literally follow him around from town to town and city to city, and they grew and grew until after a while they were kind of like a flock of friendly locusts, you know. They would show up in great numbers at some town. Oftentimes it didn't have the capacity to really support them all. What happened concomitantly, however, was that there were several very wealthy people and some monarch, you know, local small-time monarchs in his part of India who realized the value of his teaching and became, you know, students of the Buddha themselves. And so they would make available their lands for them to basically set up camp. And so what would happen is that the Buddha and his followers would move from one part of northeastern India to another seasonally and stay at different places at different times. And then when that got kind of cumbersome, like, you know, we had got up to around 5,000 or so, we were really part of the Sangha, they started regionalizing it a little bit. So there would be these sort of different centers where people, you know, would go and hang out. What those Sanghas did, what they do now, what happens in retreat Sanghas, what happens here, is that we get together and co-create a place of sanctuary. We create a place where it's safe to come and practice the Eightfold Path. We create a place where we can come and sit, where we can practice meditation together, to develop some concentration, some skillful effort, some mindfulness, really get the samadhi well established and going. And then, having done that, it makes possible the cultivation of the wisdom factors. So we enrich our knowledge of the Dharma by doing some reading, by having talks and discussions here, which is the acquisition of knowledge, actually, which then, in fact, informs the enrichment of wisdom, which in the Buddhist understanding is actually intuitive. You can think of it as like spiritual intuition. It is gaining sufficient insight into the nature that your own mind works that you can notice the times when you are about to say or do something unskillful and not do it. And you can notice beneficial intentions when they arise and then say or do something that actually has the effect of lessening or eliminating suffering for yourself or another. Okay. So you've developed the wisdom factors that then translate into how we speak and act and how we make our way in the world. Okay? All of that becomes possible because of the fact we start off, we do it together in Sangha. Without that, the perpetuation of Buddhism over the millennia would simply not have been possible. In the Anguttara Nikaya, there is an exchange between the Buddha and his attendant, Ananda. And in a lot of these exchanges, Ananda's kind of the straight man, you know, he says something and then the Buddha says, oh no, Ananda, do not say thus, you know, it's actually like this instead. And so this is one of those better known exchanges where Ananda's, they're just remarking on the spiritual community they're a part of and how rich it is and how it really seems to perpetuate the continuing development of understanding and the perfection of Buddhism in practice. And so Ananda says, well, you know, it seems to me that having noble friends and noble conversations, you know, in Sangha as we are, is fully half the holy life. And so the Buddha says, oh no, Ananda, do not speak thus. In fact, having noble friends and conversations in Sangha, such as we have here, is the entirety of the holy life. It is, in fact, what makes the holy life possible. It's one thing to read doctrines, you know, or do practices, but Sangha is where the Dharma hits the dirt, where the rubber meets the road, because either you do learn how to manifest these teachings and this wisdom and how you speak and how you act and how you make your way in the world, or you don't. And if you don't, the Dharma's failed. And just like everything else, we learn concentration, we learn mindfulness, we learn right effort by practice. You know, we study, and when we're doing that practice, eventually the wisdom factors arise. Okay. But in terms of really living the Dharma, in terms of really embodying it, making it part of who we are, that happens in Sangha. Because we have a common intent, a common purpose. So we seek to be together in ways that further that understanding. And when we blow it, as we inevitably do, we forgive each other. Because that's the nature of this way of life. Having compassionate regard for one another, opening our hearts to one another. And to the extent that we can learn how to do that in this safe place, in this safe setting, it makes it possible to start to do it more and more in our daily lives when we are not among those who are of like mind. Care and feeding of the Sangha. In ancient times, you know, when the Buddhist followers first got together and started trying to live together and practice together, as it turns out, everything was not always happy in Mr. Buddha's neighborhood. His Sangha members would get into it, and they would get into it over just about anything you can think of. And whenever they'd get into it over this, that, and the other thing, from the gross to the mundane, they'd come to the Buddha and say, all right, so here's what came up, here's the facts of the case. And what do you recommend insofar as how we go forward? So in each of these instances, they would bring the situation to the Buddha. The Buddha would give them some advice, and they started codifying it. They started writing it down, or at least memorizing it. They wrote it down sometime later. And eventually it became this kind of code of conduct for the monastic Sangha called the Vinaya. So it's one of the three sets of documents in the Tipitaka, and the Pali Canon. And so eventually we wound up with over 230 rules to live by for male members of the monastic Sangha, and another 100 or so on top of that for the nuns. Right? But what this grew to be over time was this body of custom and conduct for the monastics that made possible the perpetuation of the Theravada Buddhist tradition for the last couple of millennia. There was tremendous effort that went into creating the monastic Sangha, keeping it alive over the millennia. And we now have, I think, several hundred Theravada Buddhist sitting groups in the United States right now. You know, both lay sanghas and monastic sanghas, like the Thai Wat here in Denver, right? Which is a monastic sangha to which the public is invited for teachings. Okay. There was enormous effort that went into creating these sanghas and sustaining them. And the same is no less true of ours than it is any other, you know. We have a relatively small group of people in our Sangha who exert tremendous amounts of effort to keep this Sangha alive and well. Having moved to our new situation here, our new venue, it actually involves more effort than where we were before at the UU Church. And so This is the point in time when I warmly invite everybody who finds the Sangha here to be of benefit to them, to be, find it useful, to become more active in helping keeping it alive and well, in terms of maybe coming a little early and helping with setup. And we'll talk about some of that more here toward the end. The Dharma is perpetuated over space and time by beneficial intention. That's what the monastic Sangha has been up to for the last 2,500 years. It was the monastic Sangha in which our Western teachers in the Theravada tradition were all trained. When they came back to the West, the cultural context within which we live simply didn't make possible the establishment of the kinds of institutions that they have in Asia, a totally different tradition. And the way it's come down is that we, rather than looking to the established institutions to do all the heavy lifting, this is do-it-yourself Dharma. We do it for each other, and we do it for ourselves. There is one sort of paradox that arises in the relationship between Sangha and the Buddha's advice. You know, as he was dying, and people were lamenting, and they were freaked out, because who do we depend on for teachings now as you're getting ready to die? And he said, everything you need in order to awaken lies within you. All I did is point the way. All you need to do is continue to practice, continue to look inward, and you will find the way as well. It's called independent abiding. How do you square that with the Buddha's advice that the entirety of the holy life is being in Sangha, is being with others? And the answer to that is that although all these qualities do lie within us that make possible eventual awakening, it is the environment of Sangha that brings them forth, that creates a safe space, a fertile field, a rich opportunity to go deeply inward, to listen to the Dharma, to read it, to practice it, and to talk about it, as we do here. So those two sort of sit side by side. The Dharma doesn't work, said the Buddha, if it's not shared. And we learn how to share it by being together in community. And we learn how to share it by taking what we've learned here and sharing it with the wider world. Okay. So the future of the Dharma, as has been said over and over again, actually depends on us, as well as on our teachers and on the monastic Sangha. You know, when we talk about the Sangha, there are so many ways to think about that. You know, I've talked a little bit from time to time in here about the Deva realms and realms of existence and whatnot. There is one understanding that that is indeed another form of Sangha that is available to us in times of need. Several years ago, when I was asked to be the Dharma teacher at a wilderness Vipassana retreat. There's a 10-day retreat in the backcountry in the Sierra Nevada. I consulted with my own teaching mentor, Joseph Osteen, and said, okay, you think I'm ready for this? You know, it's going to be my first time teaching on retreat by myself. Furthermore, it's going to be in a wilderness area. And so we discussed it at some length, and he said, yeah, go ahead, go for it. And so I did, and we got out into the backcountry on the first day of the retreat. And I realized that some of the people that were on the retreat, some of them were pretty well grounded in the Dharma, and others not so much, and there were a couple that really weren't very well grounded, period. And so I was all about what have I gotten myself into And I was a bit shaken, you know, and very humbled. And so after we made camp late one afternoon, I walked out a little ways just to be by myself on a mountainside overlooking a valley, and just closed my eyes, you know, just sort of seeking to the wisdom and the strength that was going to make it possible to do this. And suddenly there was this real powerful feeling, you know, this voice that kept saying, "You are not alone. You are not alone." That it became the feeling that I very much had was that my lineage tradition was there for me. And it was almost as if I was in touch with all those who'd gone before, all those who taught before, all those who'd brought the Dharma forth to the point where I found myself in the position that I did. So of the many ways of understanding Sangha that there are, that is surely one of them. We are part of something much greater than ourselves, extending across space and time, you know, from the distant past to where we are now, and extending forth into the future as well. And the way that that extension happens and the degree of which it does happen really does depend on us. And it depends on the quality of our sangha. So I'd like to take just a few moments here toward the end just to talk about some sort of seemingly mundane things having to do with the possibility of, in 2 weeks' time, there being about 20 or 30% more people here than there are tonight. At the outside, I don't know if it's going to become, you know, if that's going to be the numbers or not. I'm really fond of this space in which we meet right now, but having grown up in the Southern Baptist Church, the way the seats are organized right now kind of gives me the creeps a little bit. It makes me feel kind of churchy. And when we were at the other venue, you know, in the upstairs chapel at the Unitarian Church, we had an opportunity to configure the room in such a way that we were more kind of fanned out and we could see each other. And there was more of a sense of connection, of you know, connectedness, of being together in Sangha. And so personally, I'm kind of interested in seeing if we can play with our space a little bit to make that more possible. I know that we've experimented with having, you know, the altar at different points around the room at different times. I don't know if we can reconfigure the chairs differently the way they are now, or if maybe we want to experiment with putting the altar over there for a little while. Let's talk about that for a minute, because indeed, in 2 weeks' time, if we do have more people coming in here, it'd be nice for us to be set up in a way that we all feel comfortable with. So what do you think? Yes?
Having an altar over there would be a very good idea, because we really can
do do more of a horseshoe kind of a thing.
Right, yeah. And
over where?
North wall.
Exit.
Yeah, that wall.
Yeah, just basically to the right of the door. Yeah. Yeah, please, in the back.
I would suggest turning each side this way, and then you create a square, right? The altar stays there, and everybody then sees each other. If you move the altar there, then we're all just facing that direction, sort of in a horseshoe, but still facing kind of one direction. Whereas if you create a square, were configured in a rectangle, you know, into a rectangle, you ended up getting everybody to see everybody to some degree. Seems, I don't know that I would move the author necessarily.
Okay.
What would that look like?
Yes, I don't think I understand.
Yeah.
Take every single chair here and turn it that way, and take every single chair here and turn it this way. Well, then you've got chairs here, and then you up there, it's a rectangle. That then all you have to do is turn your head a little bit and you see the person, whereas instead of just looking at the backs of your heads. So basically flanks of chairs, right, so that we can kind of see. And then the altar stays there.
We'd be facing each other.
Right, facing, two sides facing, and then a third side facing you. Or you can line up chairs facing this way, put the altar up higher where maybe people can see. You can put the altar here, although that's churchy too. But I think really configuring circle is the best, right?
Yeah.
And rectangle is the best.
So if we can, so maybe we could do like a long horseshoe kind of thing.
Yeah. Right.
Around the...
Yeah, it's like, that seems extreme, because if we're here, then to look at Lloyd, it's quite a... But, I mean, if we could somehow sort of turn them this way and make the rows kind of...
Right.
So that we're seeing each other more, and it's still not quite a stretch to look at you.
Yeah.
Or maybe the individual chairs in this horseshoe shape, while we're facing each other, but the individual chairs are kind of like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Or did you just say that?
Yeah, same idea.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd like for people to be able to see each other.
I would too. Miss that.
Right. Yeah.
About the old place.
It really goes a long way toward creating that sense of connection. Mm-hmm. Be able to do that. So we'll. Yeah, please, Ken.
I like the idea of the facing, but I think we do have to be aware that people coming late or very last minute are going to come through that door. So we're going to have to make a point of having those of us who are a little bit earlier sitting on the other side, so that there's space between the early comers.
Yeah, just so there's some kind of aisle or something there. Yeah. Okay. Other thoughts or reviews? Okay. Other items that are worth talking about, you were talking earlier about the various subgroups that you heard about in the Sangha, right? Like a walking group and...
I just wanted to know more about them. I sort I overheard a conversation that there were a couple of things going on out there, and I'm super interested in this book group idea.
Yes.
But I feel like if people are willing to come for 2 hours, they probably come for more things throughout the week.
Yes.
The opportunity.
Okay.
So if there was a way, I'm on the email list, and I know a lot of information goes through that portal, but if there's anything else.
Sure. Are there any members of the men's walking group? I think it's around in Wash Park, or the women's group who'd like to say just a couple of words. Yeah, please, Deb.
The women's group grew out of a gender talk that you and whatever that gal's, Michelle.
Yeah, right, Michelle Comstock.
We've been meeting for 6 years, four of which have been in my living room. I used to announce it every month or so, and it's been more word of mouth, but we are an open group. And we meet the second and fourth Tuesdays from 6:30 to 8:30 or so. And if you are interested in being on the email list and finding out the topic and you know, reminders, then come see me after Sangha, and I'll put you on the list.
Yeah,
We're also meeting this coming Tuesday. I forgot to send out the email. But yes, this coming Tuesday at my house.
Thank you, Deb. And maybe we can make a more formal announcement about that as we come up on the, maybe a flyer or something as we come up on the introductory series. Yeah, Lisa.
I know that Joe, who's not here tonight, has a new group forming. I don't know if anybody here, I'm not a member of it, but I don't know if anybody here's a member of that, but they're meeting weekly or twice a month.
Yeah, I've sat with them a few times, and we've been kind of meeting every other Tuesday.
Yeah.
But I don't know, Joe hasn't sent out an email about this coming Tuesday, so I'm not sure whether or not we're meeting. And we have been meeting at Adrian's house, but he's traveling right now.
So maybe you guys can connect.
What we will seek to do is to kind of organize all this information that we're sharing tonight into maybe a flyer that just kind of lists all the groups, and for those who might be interested, the ways who you can contact about getting more involved. Yeah, please.
Is there any men here from that men's walking group? I thought, because I know Andy was a part of that, and I think Bill went.
It's not really an open Buddhist group anymore.
It was just some friends in the neighborhood that just went for walks on, you know, in the mornings around Wash Park, and one of them's dead now, and a couple have moved away. And,
it's not walking,
it's
not walking
meditation.
No.
It's drinking coffee.
Right, you know. And, basically, from the way it's been described to me, sort of, playing, fiddling around with the idea of right speech when it comes to politics and not getting very far. So they actually like revel in a certain amount of unskillful speech. Yeah, please, Karen.
But I had the impression, also sort of third hand, that that group also does a month of service project.
Yes.
Serving to serving the pancake breakfast to the church
weekly.
There on, is it weekly?
Weekly, every Friday morning at Christ's Body or.
Lincoln.
Yeah, Bill Boswell has taken a lead role in that, so next time he's around, we can make sure the word gets out about that. Okay, well, this is, I think, a really good start in terms of, you know, bringing some fresh energy into how we configure ourselves when, again, I'll be gone next week on retreat, and then every end of the Sunday in November is when we'll be doing the introductory series. Yeah, Karen.
Well, so for the setup, do
we want to try a new configuration next time and then kind of evaluation? It might freak David out a little bit,
but
he's about to go, or should we wait until? Yeah, I don't think David would mind. No. His, you know, the Boulder Saga is set up a little to make it a little bit easier for people to see each other than this is. When I start teaching the introductory series, I would like to, for at least one night, experiment, I think, with putting the altar there and just seeing if, you know, if we can make it work with regard to the numbers, because we'd have to, you know, fan the chairs from here out to, you know, over by the, and this is going to be a period of experimentation, obviously.
And maybe the speakers are an issue, too, or maybe not. They seem to be filling the space pretty well.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you. We're obviously in transition and entering a new era, and I appreciate your participation here, checking in. Before we go our separate ways this evening, let's take our meditation posture once again, if we can. Allowing the eyes to gently close. And spending just a moment of being, of our Sangha, being in touch with one of those sanghas of which I was just speaking. Bhavatu sava mangalam prakantu sava devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava buddha nubhavina sada sante. Through the power of all the Buddhas, may you always be well. Bhavatu sabha mangalam rakantu sabha devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sabha dava nubhavena sabha. Through the power of all the dharmas, may you always be well. Bhavatu sava mangalam, rakantu sava devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava sangha nubhavena sada sote bhavantu. Through the power of all the sanghas, may you always be well. Have a good week. Be sure to be here for David next week, and I'll see you soon.